breakfast. Didn't get no lunch, but I did get 2 weeks' notice. They're gonna blow the factory up. Now I'm this. And the day ain't even done. Oh, yeah.
This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And I'm trying to figure out how we... What's happening? That's not my music. Well, we have a program today that I wanted to share with you because it puts a cap on the discussions we've been having on this thing called white supremacy. And we've been trying to define it. And we've had quite a challenge doing that. What is this thing called white supremacy? This thing that we see resurfacing as a topic of discussion in the immediate aftermath of a spate of mass killings in the United States. Well, there's good news. We have a definition. And the definition comes from a program that I did 5 years ago. And I want to share it with you because it is extraordinary because of the information it shares and the perspective it brings to the subject. What exactly is white supremacy? Well, our guest in this presented program, Dr. Jeffrey Perry, an independent working class scholar, gave us a guided tour 5 years ago based on the seminal works of historian Theodore Allen, whose two-volume book, The Invention of the White Race, chronicles the formulation by power elites in early America of a race-based system of total control. Here's the kicker. It began in the 1600s. And is the basis of what people call democracy, our democracy today. So let's turn to the program. Again, we'll be hearing as our chief guest, the person who wrote the book, Theodore Allen, passed away. But like anybody who does good work, the work survives. And it is imperative that you get to know it, because there's so much information here. It's approximately 800 pages and carefully annotated, carefully documented, and double and triple checked. So when people ask for a definition of white supremacy, here's an answer, and it's been around for a long time. Let's join Jeffrey Perry in this interview I did with him 5 years ago.
I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Monday, February the 2nd, 2015. And a very important introduction I wish to make today as we begin the designated month for Black History. Of course, I don't wait for February to discuss this matter. I think it ought to be discussed all year round, history as a whole. When I was the editor of a newspaper, the City Sun, history was in fact at the center of that paper. It was the heart of the paper. It was the signature of the paper. And it was why the paper was so well received. And people to this day tell me that I'm responsible for the fact that their house could never be cleaned out entirely because they have so many back issues of the paper. But history is important. And today's program is, I think, a very important reference point, because when we talk about African-American history, black history, we place the onus really on the people who are oppressed to retrieve for themselves the missing pages of their history. But it is a rare thing when we get presented with history from an entirely different point of view, and this point of view comes from whites, radical whites, who have taken the time to research and to document the missing pages of America's history. And in this regard, we are very lucky today to visit the work of Theodore Allen. Theodore Allen, I happen to have met, and I didn't know I actually met him. As a matter of fact, I had met him a couple of times without knowing who he was. Usually he would be at these community meetings where, you know, just we would have these information sessions and discussions at the community level, and he would just be a face in the crowd. And perhaps it was the second or third time that I had seen him that I actually talked with him and found out who he was. But he didn't tell me who he was. Someone told me about him, and that was in Crown Heights, where he lived. He was attending a session that we had in Crown Heights when the community was in turmoil over the what appeared to be the firebombing of a black woman's home, allegedly by Hasidic Jews who did not like the idea that she had rebuffed their offers to purchase her property. The crime still remains unsolved. The work of Theodore Allen comes head on with what I consider to be the bedrock of the turmoil in the United States today. And that is this notion, we call it racism, but that really is a very tidy word. It's a very cleaned up word. It's just ascetic. But when you call it what Theodore Allen calls it, which is essentially white supremacy, this notion of whiteness as a tool of control scientifically constructed to maintain racial dominance in the United States. This is quite an eye-opening thing. And the reason we're having this discussion today is that I want to encourage everyone to begin this year, to let this year be the year that you build your library. You have to have a library in your home. And Theodore Allen's work would be one of the essentials in your library. You've got to have these books because they give you an understanding that you won't have otherwise. Because this is seminal work. This is the work that lays out the premise so you understand all the things that come behind it. They then begin to make sense to you. But the way he presents it and the construction of the theory, and you see now the theory being applied, the applied science of it, will then make sense to you. We have a great fortune in having as our guide today Dr. Jeffrey Perry. He's an independent working class scholar whose work focuses on the role of white supremacy as a retardant to progressive social change. He has done a great deal of work in this area, but he has actually been the person who preserved and inventoried the Theodore Allen papers. He edited and introduced Allen's Class Struggle and the Origin of Racial Slavery, the Invention of the White Race. I want to repeat that. Class Struggle and the Origin of Racial Slavery, the Invention of the White Race, and has written several introductions and appendices for the new work that has just been published, Allen's two-volume, The Invention of the White Race, which is a compendium I urge you to add or to begin if you haven't yet started your library. This is a good volume of work. These two volumes are good to have, and I urge you to get them. We'll talk about them later. Jeff Perry also preserved and inventoried the Hubert H. Harrison papers. We discussed that previously on the program. We also discussed Theodore Allen previously, but today we get to know him more fully. The Hubert Harrison papers are at Columbia University, and he edited a Hubert Harrison reader and authored Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. What Perry has spent his life doing as an independent scholar is focusing, again, like Theodore Allen, on this issue of white supremacy and the centrality of struggle against white supremacy to progressive social change. It's a long introduction today, Jeff, but it needs to be said. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Utrice. And it was a wonderful introduction, and I think you have a great grasp of Allen's work and its importance.
Well, I want to start with perhaps the boldest thing that was said in a little sentence, and it goes like this. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. In 1916, a year before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Harbor, Massachusetts. 1619, thank you. 20 Africans captured by Dutchmen from a Spanish slave ship were sold to colonists at Jamestown, Virginia. There were various classes of English, Scottish, Irish, and other Europeans in Jamestown at the time, but no white people, says historian Theodore Allen. The term white, he said, appeared for the first time in colonial records 60 years later, Allen says. And so the question today that you will take us on this guided tour with Jeff is, how and why was whiteness created? Why the need for classification based on skin color? And why have racism and white supremacy endured?
Thank you. Yes, Allen writes, when he writes that there were no white people in early Virginia, he bases it on 870 calendar years of colonial records. So he spent 25 or 30 years going through all these materials. And, you know, he cites different periods, he'll give quotes, you know, confirming that. And the phrases that appear are Englishmen, Scotsmen, Dutchmen, you know, but the word white does not appear. But he's not simply saying that the word doesn't appear as a status, but that the white race as we know it was not functioning. And that is the story that he tells in these two volumes. He does many, many things, and I want to reemphasize what you said. Given the importance of matters of class and race in this country, Allen's work is a real foundation for taking a serious, new, and radical approach to how we understand history and how we wage struggle in the future. So basically the story he tells is, and he focuses on Virginia, which is the pattern-setting colony. Seven of the first 12 presidents eventually come from there. But it's where they set up the pattern of racial oppression that develops in this country. And at first, when they start setting up the colony, they quickly turn to capitalist agriculture, and they're producing tobacco. And the principal relations of production, if you will, for the laboring people are either wage earners or tenants at half. They have rights carried over from England. There is no bond servitude, no slavery. And that's when the first Africans come, they're introduced into that society, and there's no indication that they, once they got on shore, were enslaved, right? And what happens... a major qualitative break, a change happens in 1622, which Alan discusses. Now, first off, what's crucial to understand, I think, is England alone, of all the European colonizing powers, was sending surplus laborers there, surplus laborers from England, because England had developed capitalism in agriculture. They had excess poor, and they were shipping them to Virginia, as well as English, Scots. And so, unlike other places in the Americas, where the European percentage was relatively small within a short period of time, in Virginia, the primary workforce for most of the 17th century was European, right? And this is very important for what develops later. So what happens, many things happen, but in 1622, in March of 1622, the Powhatan Confederation, the Native Americans in the area of Jamestown, rise up. They kick out the governor. They burn Jamestown. I'm jumping ahead. They rise up and they attack the colony and they kill one third of the colonists in one day, and another one third die within a year. And the ruling elite who control the supplies now have the remaining colonists very much at a disadvantage. They're totally dependent on the ruling elite. And the ruling elite imposes a new status of labor on the laboring population, the majority of the laboring population, and it is chattel bond servitude. That chattel, you could be bought and sold. You would serve 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and you could be bought and sold. This was a qualitative break from labor conditions in England and from English labor law. And this is done after 1622. And throughout the 17th century, the majority of laborers who come to Virginia are chattel bond servants. What they call it in Virginia, and you'll see in the records, is custom of the country. Now, many of us have been taught, all we hear in our history courses growing up is there were indentured servants and black slaves, right? White indentured servants and black slaves. But the majority of these Europeans were not signing an indenture, which is a contract over there. They were having the chattel bond servitude imposed as the custom of the country here. And there was no established system of racial slavery in the early period. Now, going on with that story, and I just want to call people's attention to two things. One, my webpage, jeffreybperry.net, has all kinds of free information on this. And two, the historian Lerone Bennett Jr., who people may be familiar with, he was senior editor of Ebony, writes Before the Mayflower, a number of very important books, but his book, The Shaping of Black America, discusses what Alan discusses also in great depth and detail. But basically the picture they draw is for the laboring people in Virginia, the conditions for the European Americans and Afro-Americans, conditions were very similar. I mean, they were very oppressive, and people didn't live long. As Bennett phrases it, it was no Garden of Eden, right? But, and the bond servitude, and there are many aspects of the bond servitude, the male supremacist aspects, which Alan gets into in great depth, but I want to move ahead right now on the key aspects of this first story. So after 1622, conditions continue to deteriorate for the laboring population, and between 1660 and 1676, there are 10 laboring class and bond servant revolts in Virginia. And so social control is a major issue for the ruling elite, because this ruling elite like the ruling elites every place, has a twofold task, or at least under capitalism, right? They want to make profit, and they have to maintain social control. Twofold task. So they're having great difficulty maintaining social control. And this culminates in 1676, 1677, in a struggle called Bacon's Rebellion. Many aspects of that struggle, but I want to focus on the second, the latter stages of that struggle, the Civil War stages, when the people at the bottom of society, the European Americans and African Americans, fight hand in hand, demanding their freedom from bondage. Now, there's one account that Alan likes to cite. It's from a captain named Thomas Grantham, and this will just reinforce a couple of the points I've made. But Grantham, who was sent to put down the insurrection, writes, and this is a major account, he writes, "I there met 400 English and Negroes in arms. They were much dissatisfied at the surrender of West Point, saying I had betrayed them, and thereupon some were for shooting me, and others were for cutting me in pieces." He lies then, and he says, I told them I would willingly surrender myself till they were satisfied, and did engage them, and that they were all pardoned and freed from their slavery. Then, in the final stages, after I had persuaded them to go home, there still remained 80 Negroes and 20 English, which would not deliver their arms. So, in that document right there, you see that the Europeans are not, they're not being called white, right? They're not acting as whites. They're showing great solidarity with the Afro-Americans, and they're fighting together, demanding their freedom from bondage. Now, these social, and as I mentioned, there have been 10 previous insurrections or bondservant revolts. So the ruling elite sought to devise a means of social control. And to get to the nub of this story, what Alan argues, and again, I want to point out that his two-volume work is The Invention of the White Race. I hope we get a chance to talk why he's focusing on this later. And volume one is Racial Oppression and Social Control. So you see these key concepts that he's focusing on. So what he describes is that system in which his three main theses are that the ruling elite in Virginia, in response to Bacon's Rebellion, in response to the solidarity shown in Bacon's Rebellion and the labor solidarity, invented the white race as a ruling class social control formation. I just want to take a second to stop before I go with the other two theses. He emphasizes ruling class social control formation because Alan is very well thought out, and he's clear if you simply argue that race is a social construct, you leave the back door open for all kinds of white supremacist theorizing, such as the Dinesh D'Souza's and the Daniel Patrick Moynihan's, and those who will argue, yes, race is a social construct, but what would you expect if you have people of inferior cultures or inferior family life? Alan's having none of that. He's laying it right where it belongs, at the feet of the ruling, the bourgeoisie, the plantation elite back in Virginia, and what gets set up is in their interest. He goes on to argue how they develop their system of social control is by instituting a system of white race privileges, and he goes through the lists and the laws that get passed, and he describes the privileges, and then he makes the crucial and important point that the racial privileges that are getting extended to the Europeans and being propagandized in the means of the day, they're put on the church doors and their courthouse doors, and they're read every Sunday, and they're propagandized, but he makes the very crucial point, and this is what truly distinguishes Alan's work from so much that's out there. Alan argues that the system of racial privileges was not only ruinous to the interests of African Americans, they were also disastrous for European American workers. Workers, right? He's saying it's not in their class interest, in their interest as poor and working people. Now, what Alan is doing, just to put this in a little of more context, he is challenging what I would argue and what he argued are the two main ideological props of white supremacy amongst European-American workers. European-American workers may want to wage the good struggle. They may, and I come out of the labor movement, by the way. I'm 30-plus years actively in the labor movement and still active as a retiree. And the two main ideological props that Alan is challenging are, one, the notion that racism is innate, that white supremacism is innate. Because if it's innate, you can't fight it, right? It's got to be there all the time. So he's challenging that. And the second one he's challenging is the notion that white workers, quote, benefit from the system of racial privileges. And he is arguing, no, this is not in their interest at all. What's in their interest is solidarity with their Afro-American co-workers, right? He says these, quote, privileges are a poison bait. It's like a shot of heroin. You're told it's good for you, but it's not. And he takes and deepens one of the major slogans of the labor movement, you know, and laboring people who've been through struggle know the importance of sticking together, just as civil rights activists knew the importance of, you know, sticking together when you're facing the barking dogs and the attacks, you know, as you're protesting. And so Alan takes slogan like, an injury to one is an injury to all, which is one of the bedrocks of the labor movement. And he says, yes, that is true. And he says, and so is the following. Solidarity forever means privileges never. Have to challenge the system of white privileges throughout. So as Alan tells the story, and he does it in great detail, I want to mention these books are 800 pages, 35 pages, these two volumes, 35% are footnotes and appendices. It is thoroughly documented work. Alan is an independent, he's a working class scholar, and he has great integrity. When he writes, he also knows the contending arguments, and he tries to raise them in their best perspective, if you will, and then address them. So it's very rich material. We have videos and audios. One of the videos that was done when after his book came out just passed 40,000 yesterday, 2 days ago on YouTube, 4 days ago actually. But people might want to look at it because that helps introduce you to his work. Another thing that he talks about, though, is as they develop the white race, there's the corollary. It's not just extending the privileges to the European Americans, but it's intensifying the oppression on the African Americans. So it's the extending of servitude to lifetime hereditary bond servitude. But then there's even more. They go after the free African Americans. And there were African Americans in 17th century, as Allen and Bennett and others point out, if they were free, had certain rights. They could vote. They could own land. They could own other people, you know, at the time. And they did. Some did, right? But in the 1720s, they passed new laws which take all these rights away from, quote, free Negroes. And when the governor of Virginia is asked to explain back to the powers that be in England, they don't even understand. They say, well, if these people, you know, own property, why can't they vote, you know? And he says, we did it to fix a perpetual brand on free Negroes and mulattoes. So it's a kind of a conscious effort. And Alan argues that the oppression of black people, this racial oppression of black people, is a corollary of the white identity that they're trying to develop, right? So they're tied together, these two concepts. So Alan is making profound arguments, and he does this in the context of his other historical work. That's the basic theory he lays out for the invention of the white race. There's much more to that. But I want to put it in a little deeper context now. And I mentioned the two arguments he goes after, that racism is innate and that white workers benefit. And for the people who have like to read some of the history, the first argument, he is particularly associated with a historian named Winthrop Jordan, who wrote White Over Black, American Attitudes, and you can see by the title he's equating white with American, 1550 to 1812, I think he writes it. And Jordan argues that racism is an unthinking decision. The other historian that Alan's challenging is the work of Edmund Morgan, who many people today, even progressives, use, you know, to discuss 17th century. But at key points, Morgan makes the argument that there were too few free poor to matter, implying that they were getting promoted into the middle class, which wasn't happening. That's one of the main points that Alan makes, is these people were being sold as white race stuff, but it was not improving their they were not moving out of their class. They were still laboring class Europeans, and he subsequently points out how down south, where the white supremacy was most pronounced, the conditions were always worse for laboring people. Alan takes on those arguments, but his deeper argument and the background for it is the following. When he starts writing in the 1960s on this, and he had a lifetime of activism. He had been a United Mine Worker local president 3 times. He had taught political economics in New York City for over a decade and had a history of left activism. But he kind of sets out on his own course in the 1960s, and he's addressing 2 main questions, 2 deep issues. One, how do you explain the relatively low level of class consciousness in this country overall, right? When you compare it to other countries, particularly the advanced capitalist countries, the European countries, they have labor parties, you know, social democratic parties of significance and all of this. And the U.S., we don't, right? That's one question he's trying to address. And the deeper question is, why no radical social change in this country? And what he comes to the conclusion in the beginning in the 1960s, that the answer to this, what has held us back so profoundly, is white supremacism, white supremacy, its retarding effect, particularly on the European American workers. And so he's going to go after all of that. And one thing he does before he turns to writing The Invention of the White Race, which he starts, Alan lives from 1919 to 2005, and he starts writing he starts developing that theory in the mid-70s, but a decade earlier, as he's writing, he starts out looking at 3 crises in U.S. history. And this work is totally instructive for us today as we try and wage struggle in the 21st century. And he looks at previous periods in U.S. history. The 3 periods he looks at, the key periods, Civil War, Reconstruction is 1, Populism is 2, and the Depression, 1930s, is the 3rd. And he argues that in each and every one of those periods, as the people at the bottom of society, labor, working class, African American, Latino, as people start coming together and pushing for struggle and for change, the ruling class has effectively and successfully beat back those efforts by turns to white supremacy and reinforcing white privileges. Very quickly, the examples from the Depression are instructive because we will encounter similar things today, as we move on and as struggle heightens. But I would point to labor legislation, the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and Social Security until 1951. These are the laws that came out of that New Deal, excluded domestic and agricultural workers, roughly 70% of your black and Latin workforce down south. Relief is federal monies, but it was controlled locally, meant down south great disparities. 2 other crucial examples, the GI Bill. The GI Bill, you can get a house with 0 down payment and low interest loan. And the statistics for the New York, New Jersey area where I live, 67,000 GI loans were awarded, less than 100 go to families of color. That is how you get the ring of white suburbs around New York and every other city in this country. And the final one, which I think is crucial, again, coming from my labor background, and I would like to see people consciously addressing more, is the 2-to-1 black-to-white unemployment ratio. In 1929, at the start of the Great Depression, the black-to-white unemployment ratio was 1-to-1, which makes sense if you think about it, because black people were brought here to labor. But by 1947, after all those programs of the New Deal and the post-war deployment, redeployment. The black to white unemployment ratio was 2-1 or some close variant of that, and that's all it's been as long as you or I have been alive, right? So this is some of what goes into Allen's analysis, and he explains how, in part, how that happens. And it's, again, history, so much is more, the type of history we really have to dig deeper on. But he points out that when FDR had his administration, his basis of support included trade unions, urban political machines, but the Dixiecrats down south, the same people, the forebears, if you will, of the current generation who are now in the Republican Party and the Tea Party and things like this. And they shaped. A historian up at Columbia, Ira Katz Nelson, has written a book, When Affirmative Action Was White, which describes how each and every program from the New Deal into the 1960s was shaped in its white supremacist fashion. So what Allen, you know, Allen takes all of this analysis, and it's crucial, I think, for the work we do today, and he argues that we have to develop a strategy for social change which understands the class nature of the society and who's controlling this and who's driving it. But we have to understand that what they rely on for social control is white supremacism, white supremacy. And what we have to beat them on is that, because it's not in European-American laboring people's interest or African-Americans' interest, Latin. So we have to, this white supremacy is both what they base their support on, but it's also their Achilles heel. So Allen basically argues is we have to develop a strategy focuses and directs the main blow at white supremacy. Now, to elaborate a little more on that, the other person I work on who you mentioned is Hubert Harrison, and let us not omit Harrison here at the start of Black History Month, although, like you, I agree, every month, you know, we should be doing this. But Harrison, early 20th century, known, A. Philip Randolph calls him the father of Harlem radicalism, and J.A. Rogers calls him the leading Afro-American intellect of his era. But one of Harrison's profound concepts, he writes, writing about the U.S., politically, the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. And it's an extraordinarily powerful metaphor, because a touchstone is a black stone. You rub it against the metal to see if it's really gold or not. And we can use that. We can apply that at every area we look at. Jobs, housing, education, health care, incarceration rates, pick an issue, and let's put it to the test. How are black people faring, and what are we going to do about it, right? But in that same passage, and this is where I'll take a breather and you can, in that same paragraph, after Harrison writes, the Negro is the touchstone, he goes on to say that true democracy and equality, essentially this is what he says, true democracy and equality for Afro-Americans implies a revolution startling to even think of. It's the same concept that Allen gets at, right? And by that, I think Harrison, this is back in 1911, he's foreshadowing the 1960s when the civil rights black liberation struggle is a catalyst for social change in all areas. The anti-war movement, the student movement, the women's movement, gay and lesbian rights, etc., etc. And it's a catalyst because the struggle is just, the cause is just, but also because it hit so directly at how the ruling class maintains social control. So I think there's a great deal to learn from Allen's work and Harrison's work. That's why I spend a lot of time on them. I want to mention to people on my webpage, again, which is my name, jeffreybperry.net, you'll find all kinds of free information on Harrison and Allen's work, but in the top corner on the left is an article which pulls some of this together, what I'm talking about. It's entitled The Developing Conjuncture and Some Insights from Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen on the Centrality of the Struggle Against White Supremacy.
Well, great foray into the subject so far, Jeff, but I want to ask about this. Sure. You're clear, and as was Theodore Allen, as was Hubert Harrison, about the problem and the genesis of the problem. Here's the issue now. White supremacy has also invaded the people who you are looking to or who are being looked to be part of the vanguard of the movement against it. The left is riddled with white supremacy. So what do you see as the likelihood that this group that is supposed to be in the vanguard of change, A, will not accept the fact that they are actually proponents of white supremacy, for the most part, that they have signed on to it, that they enjoy white privileges, and they don't intend to give them up?
Well, very good question, Eutrice. And this is parenthetical, but people can find this article on my webpage also. When Allen starts writing back in the 60s, he pioneers white skin privilege analysis. It's 20 years before that which comes later, which people are familiar with if they go to Wikipedia. And Allen's was a much deeper, more class-based analysis. But one of his first articles was entitled, "Can White Radicals," and then he crosses out radicals, and he just puts workers, "Can white workers be radicalized?" Because he was addressing the same issue and all the problems, you know, that you're just hinting at. But I actually am optimistic, and I'll give a few examples and a few reasons why. One, if people look at my webpage, on the opening page when they get to it, down the left-hand column, I have an article which describes work that we did over a long period of time. As I said, I worked over 30 years in Jersey City at the big bulk mail center, 4,000 workers, and into New York local and places like this. And this is in the period when we were pumping City Sun, your paper that you mentioned earlier, work. And but what we did in the workplace, is we functioned from this approach that every issue we looked at, we were going to look at how's white supremacy shaping it, and how are we going to address that? And it's not hard to find, because it's every issue. And we regularized our approach. It wasn't just spontaneous, oh, there was an incident, and then we're... You're there, right?
Yes, go ahead, sorry.
No problem. We would focus, you know, on a regularized basis, and whether it was the treatment of pregnant women or the discipline practices, whatever issue, we would address it, and people, at first, they're looking, is this for real, you know, and things like this, but as we did it, and we studied, and we showed them that we were not going to defend race privileges, right? We were going to challenge them and say, no, it's more important we stick together. We're not going to, because the bosses constantly try and play that favoritism, as people who've worked know, right? And so we developed that work, and at one high point around, I guess it was around 86, when the anti-apartheid movement was really pretty big in the U.S., in Jersey City, which is similar to parts of Brooklyn that you're probably familiar with from when you were editing and what you were just kind of talking about, you know, Jersey City, Bayonne, places like this, we had a workforce that of 4,000 workers, probably 70% or more European Americans, but we had 3,000 out of 4,000 workers in that workplace wearing anti-apartheid buttons for the first time in their life. You know, I mean, these are just some indications, but there were many other struggles we waged too. But I you know, having attempted to put these arguments into practice, I believe, it can be done. But people, this is the most powerful country in the world, and the ruling elite dominates the media. They dominate a lot of the ideology we're taught in the universities and nonprofits and this and that, right? We're flooded with it and sound bites and all of this. And I think what we have to do is we have to wage struggle, and we have to wage struggle in hosts of areas you know, whether it be housing, jobs campaigns, you know, ending the wars and using that money for what we need, you know, those jobs, the education, all of this, but everything pointing out the white supremacist aspect of it. We have to build, what we have to build has to be based on that understanding as a priority. It's not like what you mentioned again before, but there are some left groups, and I have friends in many of these groups, but when they have their laundry list of demands, number 7 might be, oh yeah, we're against racism or something like that. What I'm saying, what Allen was saying, is it's central. It is how they maintain control in this country, how the ruling class maintains control, and we have to take them on that. Now, another thing that I think is very important is what Alan does. So, again, in the political work, we got to go after the gap. I mean, the gap between rich and poor is at record proportions, and there's been much in the media recently on this. We have to go after that, and we have to point out the disparities. And in that Developing Conjuncture article, I show the great class disparities in U.S. society, but then I have another section that shows the white supremacist shaping of each area, right? Whether it's incarceration, poverty rates, whatever. And so we have to go after that. We have to deal with jobs, taxing, housing, education, health care, gerrymandering. There's no end. The foreign policy, the war foreign policy, these, quote, wars on terrorism. But we also have to, on the ideological front, and that's why I so appreciate how you're opening this month, you know, with this work from Alan, we have to go after white supremacy ideologically, historically, so in practice, but historically in ideology. And just to take it a little further, what Alan is arguing, in case people have not really fully grasped what I'm saying today, is that the white race was invented as a ruling class social control formation. It is not genetic. He says it is the principal historic guarantor of ruling class domination in this country. He says it's an all-class formation, but because the European-American laborers buy into it, if you will, it is the principal form of class collaboration in the U.S. Class collaboration is, you know, again, from workers who've been in struggles and stuff, workers got to stick together. And when somebody starts siding with the boss, either up front or on the side or whatever, that's class collaboration. That's a betrayal of your co-workers. So Alan's arguing that the white race is the principal form of class collaboration, and he takes it to the point, and this is again, and he writes this both in that book and in other things, and I cite quotes, but Alan argues there is nothing positive in white identity, nothing, right? And he says, so he's trying to get European American workers to break from this white race social control formation, break from it in practice, break from it in theory.
But at the same time, it has been so successful as an applied science. This social construct has been so carefully put together and has been so successful in maintaining the controlling class over the controlled class. And it has been so well done, and all of its elements carefully, you know, put together, that it actually has also been exported. So we have not only the problem here in the United States, we have its various versions all over the world. Yeah. Now, how do you deal with that?
Well, I'm focusing primarily right here, you know, although, you know, we could talk a little more about abroad. But what I'm saying is I think we have to go after it in practice, and we have to go after it ideologically. And I think we have to get this information out. We have to get, because people, even progressives, if you will, people who are in the struggle, I mean, I will go and I will look and I'll see people arguing that all white people benefit from white privileges. The gap between rich and poor, not that European Americans don't get more than African Americans, I'm not saying that at all, but it's a poison bait. The gap between rich and poor is at record proportions. The ruling elite in this country is the most powerful in the history of the world. It is not surprising that they dominate the media, that they influence worldwide. But I think what we have to do is we have to counter in our struggles here, in our ideological work, in our ties, our international ties. One thing, just this is one little minor example, but I very much understand what you're talking about in terms of how they export it. And I recently was talking with Cynthia McKinney, who's, you know, doing work on Venezuela and had the effect, you know, white supremacy has had, or they've tried to use it down there. But one thing I think we want to pay attention to, aside from all these other issues, is the census. And you're probably familiar with the fact that in the U.S. census, the Hispanic, quote, Hispanics, are allowed to choose their race, right? And the statistics that are coming forth are that there was an increase in Hispanics identifying as white of 3%, I think it was, between 2000 and 2010, and even more. There are all these pressures, as they have been historically for the past few centuries, for groups coming to the U.S. to, quote, become white, to identify. We've got to challenge that, but there's a good basis for opposition also amongst those people who are coming from countries where historically they haven't had the racial structure that we've had in the U.S. That's one of the points when I write about Harrison. I talk about Harrison comes from St. Croix, but it's very similar to Barbados, Jamaica, and the Anglo-Caribbean in general. And in St. Croix, it wasn't the not that it was a Garden of Eden again, but it's not the vicious, virulent white supremacy that is developed in the U.S. And I go into great depth in discussing it in both the Harrison book and in some of these articles. And Harrison talks about it. When he comes to the U.S., he's shocked by what he encounters in the U.S. lynching. You know, the vicious white supremacy. Claude McKay comes from Jamaica, and he says, "I never encountered such a bitter racial hatred." So, and I know you know, from friends and experiences, people coming from elsewhere in the world are still shocked by what they encounter here. But that's a basis to work with, because there's some people who haven't been so deeply ingrained with this and are willing to struggle against it, as was the case with those early Afro-Caribbean immigrants of Harrison's generation. I think if we can wage our struggles, particularly if we stop waging all these wars, we stop supporting all of this, I think we can make progress. I just think we have to understand that white supremacy is also central to what's going on in the Mideast, you know, to what goes on in Africa, you know, to their policies. And we have
to like these.
Oh my, you got a spicy something?
Sorry, yes. Hello?
I'm listening.
Yeah, that's it. I don't know if that... I think this is the direction we have to go. I think it's important that we start building the struggle here, because this is where we can contribute. We can probably be most effective in our contributions, and we support and work with those who are struggling worldwide.
Well, as we close, could you tell us a bit, Jeff, about this two-volume book? Because I'm recommending that people begin to build their knowledge base, especially those who envision themselves as being involved this year, participating in creating change and hopefully doing so effectively, they have to be armed. So tell us about this two-volume work and how people can get access to it.
Great. Again, there are links on my page, but you can get it. The two-volume works, Alan first wrote them in 1994 and 1997. They were published by Verso Books, which is right in Brooklyn, right? And Verso Books came out with a new edition in 2012, for which I wrote new introductions, very expanded indexes, so people can find things in the books. And I did internal study guides, 25 pages for each volume, because these are very dense volumes, and sometimes people might not be familiar with some of the history, you know, as Alan goes through things. So I try and give you something that you can work with, and it's good for study groups, for individuals. And those books can be got if you go to the Verso Books website and look up Theodore W. Allen, The Invention of the White Race, there's Volume 1, Racial Oppression and Social Control, Volume 2, The Origin of Racial Oppression in Anglo-America. They're being sold for 40% off, they're paperback, 40% off with free shipping and a bundled ebook, which is wonderful, has great appeal, particularly to the younger generation who are very familiar with this stuff. So the material is there. Alan also, knowing how important this work was, and these are, again, dense volumes, he did a two-page summary of the argument of the invention of the white race at a publication, an online publication called Cultural.
Well, that brought to an end our conversation between this incredible historian. We have Jeff. I'm blocking on his last name. Why am I doing that? Jeff Perry, of course. I think you get a sense from our discussion 5 years ago that what people think is white supremacy, based on the discussions we've had and things that we've been bandying around, and what people like Hubert Harrison and others, including and especially because we focused on him particularly today in this discussion, what we mean by I'm losing my page here. By white supremacy, you see entirely different accountings, entirely different definitions of white supremacy. And so I recommend that you get serious and start doing some reading. And from reading, hopefully, will come your involvement, your direct involvement in one way or the other. And we will see a change, hopefully, because people understand it better. I guarantee you that people who call themselves white supremacists don't know about white supremacy. They have no clue. But hopefully, we will see a change the more people learn, the more people read, and that is what is important. I'm happy to share this with you because it was very, very important. It contained a lot of information, and it should take some time for you to get through these 800 pages that he's talking about. But Theodore Allen and Hubert Harrison and others warned us a long time ago. And here we are today, not even understanding that this concept was developed as far back as the 16 and 1700s in good old USA. Thanks for listening. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.